Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tucker Perkins, and welcome to Path to Zero. Path to Zero is where I'm having conversations with innovators and trend spotters, big idea people about our journey towards a low-carbon future. I love hearing the perspectives of really smart people who can talk about the practical limitations we face, the current frustrations we're navigating, and I'm really interested in opportunities that might be right in front of us. A quick reminder, on our website, cleanamericanenergy.us, I'm posting content in our environmental newsroom on a regular basis. I invite you to have a look, where you'll also find articles from influencers across the energy space. Today, I'm stoked. I get to talk to an influencer that I really admire. Ken Silverstein is the senior energy contributor to Forbes magazine, and he's my guest on this episode of Path to Zero. Ken, such a privilege to have you on Path to Zero. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you, Tucker, for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
I really consider you such a huge influencer in this energy space. You've been recognized as one of the most intriguing people in media. And in fact, you've produced work for outlets from Energy Biz Insider to the Breakthrough Institute to really the biggest, in my mind, of tier one business publications. Your platform at Forbes, I think you've been there almost 9 years now, brings all that home. But some people who listen to Path to Zero may not know you quite as well. Before we really get into the conversation of the day, give us a brief background on yourself and how you got to this place in your career.
I wanted to be a journalist from the time I was in college. I didn't set out to be an energy journalist or a business journalist. I was just more interested in getting in the Washington game and being a part of Capitol Hill and covering the president. And in the mid-90s, when I started to really get going in this industry, in this field, that's when energy was really becoming a mainstream beat. It was climate change. It was nuclear energy. It was natural gas. Enron was breaking through. And in terms of this particular beat, I was just in the right place at the right time. And I was a newspaper writer. I was a magazine journalist. And then I became a columnist. And that's really most of what I do today is I write columns.
I noticed, really, it was hard to escape the fact that our careers have been very much on a parallel path. I started in the energy world and the natural gas world and working with Enron. And I noticed that you really started, at least some of the earlier energy work, was your own covering of Enron. Was that the catalyst that really got you involved in energy?
That I think that's probably an accurate statement. Not Enron per se, but when Enron came along, it sort of reinvented business at the time. Now, in hindsight, some of the influences that it had were negative, as we know. But the idea of rethinking the energy sector and rethinking business, and it sort of set the tone for, where the energy sector was going. And so they needed people to cover this, to cover this new energy world. Now, that part of the experiment flopped, as we know. And I was right there when it happened, and I covered it. And I think that's when my name started to surface as being an energy journalist.
You know, I never really thought about it at the time of how much of a disruptor Enron was. But now, as I listen to you speak, I clearly remember, weather derivatives and just so many of the different products that they were beginning to talk about then, even as energy as a service. You've been around for that. That's 30 some years now. What What do you see in terms of the major trends and realistically even the disruptive moments that you would say have dramatically shaped the world of energy, particularly as it relates to the world we live in today?
Well, you know, back when Enron was coming into being, it was called the Brave New World of Energy or something to that effect. And everybody was hyping it. As we know, all that sort of fell flat. But it did open up competition, at least in the wholesale world of energy, much less so in the retail sector, but among wholesale buyers of electricity. And now, so that was the late 90s, and this is now 2020. There's all these distributed energy resources that I think have really reshaped the energy world. That's on-site energy, microgrids, battery storage, which is all coming into being, and it's becoming very real. Wind and solar are cheaper than they've ever been before. And it's not just a pipe dream. It's very real. And all of these people that sort of tried to pour cold water on it all these years, I think, have been quieted a bit.
Yeah, fascinating to think back there. I think about the personality of Ken Lay, and I don't know that it got any bigger than that in the 90s. Who are the big personalities that shape the energy world today? You have a top five list or something for people that you really think are setting the direction of energy? And then I'd certainly include power in my description of energy today.
Yeah, so I think the big one is Elon Musk. I'm a great admirer of Elon Musk. In fact, I just bought a Tesla. So I'm really a big fan of who he is and what he's accomplished. So Elon Musk, I think, has really transformed the energy sector, not just in terms of creating electric vehicles, but what he's done for battery storage and the potential there in the area of for the power sector per se. And Bill Gates is a big investor in terms of nuclear energy and other sort of potential energy technologies that are on the cutting edge. And he's a real thinker, and I'm a tremendous fan of both of those men. In the power sector, there was Jim Rogers, formerly of Duke Energy, who was always on the cutting edge of, Jim passed away. He was a great guy, always returned my calls, always spoke to me. Tom Fanning of Southern Company, another man who has taken a very conservative utility and transformed it into a real comprehensive energy company. These are all men that have advanced the field of energy, whether it's electric vehicles or the power sector or these cutting edge technologies.
One of the things, it's been interesting to read a lot of your work and try to get a sense of your own thoughts, but one of the areas that really, I guess, confounds me, for lack of a better way, and you talk about intellectual honesty, is that a lot of people tend to believe that electrification and decarbonization are synonyms, that if we could just electrify, then in fact we would have reduced carbon. And in fact, some of the men that you just mentioned, particularly Duke, tend to be at the forefront of that. Do you tend to agree with that statement that electrification is a synonym for decarbonization?
It's a subset of decarbonization. It's not the same thing. Electrification, of course, is contingent on from where the electricity comes. But it is a mechanism by which we reduce carbon levels in the atmosphere. There are other methods, meaning decarbonization has other broader components to it. So electrification is just merely a subset of a major subset, but not the only one.
You have written routinely about two subjects that I find, in my own beliefs, are core to probably the future of particularly U.S. energy. And one, no one wants to talk about nuclear energy, but you have written a few articles that are at least tend to put nuclear energy in a favorable light. You tend to agree with that statement?
Very much so. I have been a major nuclear proponent for a long time. It's a clean source of energy. It produces 24/7. It's safe. I understand all of the arguments against nuclear energy. The main one being the high cost of construction, which sort of puts it off limits in the United States, but countries like China are going full steam ahead, and I guess we'll learn from China's experience and then adapt that here. But you can't achieve net zero emissions without ultimately relying on nuclear energy.
You know, to me, it appears so clean cut. In fact, sometimes it's so clear that I feel like I've missed something, because clearly we have wonderful intermittent sources. Wind, sun would be the right. Two big ones. But in order to balance that, you have to have something that's available when the wind's not blowing or the sun's not shining. And there you either become big baseload plants like nuclear or natural gas, or you build lots of batteries. And at least in my own analysis, sometimes I struggle with not only the financial cost of batteries, but the environmental implications of them. So it's interesting that you write about that. As you kind of see some of the policies coming out, it's interesting as we kind of get into this political arena now, you see the Trump plan, if that's such a thing, or the Biden plan. What does a Silverstein plan look like?
Well, I'm not in public policy, so I don't have a plan. But I do cover the people who do have a plan. Joe Biden's plan is a progressive plan. He wants to reach net zero by, I think, 2035, 15 years from now. And he would do so by relying mostly on renewable energy. That does not preclude the use of natural gas, because natural gas will be needed to fire up when the wind stops blowing or the sun stops shining. Those natural gas plants work in tandem with renewable energy. And moreover, natural gas will still be needed to the natural gas liquids to is feedstock for the manufacturing and chemical sectors. So I think Joe Biden recognizes this. Again, he was part of the Obama administration, and the Obama administration recognized that the role of natural gas is a bridge fuel until we can ultimately get to 100% clean energy. But that bridge, even by most environmental standards, is a decades long bridge. In terms of the president, his policy is to rely on the traditional fuels. There's not really a lot of creative thinking there. He appreciates the role that oil has had in the economy, that coal had during the Industrial Revolution, that natural gas is having right now. And his policies rely very heavily on promoting those fuels, because they've been around a long time and they're proven. But he denies climate change. Therefore, implicit in that is he's not willing to make the investments in carbon-free technologies and carbon-free fuels, which means we don't advance, which means we don't reach a net zero goal ultimately. And the manifestation of this is we're witnessing it now, for example, with these wildfires out west and the high temperatures in California, 130 degrees inland in the month of September. So there needs to be policies that are more forward-thinking, that help us with this challenge of reaching a net zero goal. And Biden certainly recognizes that and is trying to get us to that point.
Yes, that's well said. Well, you mentioned a lot of great names. We talk about Ken Lay, you just talk about Trump, Biden, you mentioned quite a few other people. You have clearly been around a lot of personalities in this space. Does any one interview or any one personality really stand out for you as kind of a memorable moment?
Yes, I think I interviewed in the late 90s, Leon Sullivan, who this is not energy per se. So Leon Sullivan was born in West Virginia. He was born dirt poor, and he went on to become a reverend in Philadelphia, and he had a major flock. He won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He was asked by General Motors in the 1980s to be a part of its board, and he persuaded them that if they did not withdraw from South Africa, that this would break the back of apartheid. And so he persuaded General Motors to withdraw from South Africa if the apartheid government did not cease. And then with that came all of these other corporations that said they would pull out of South Africa. And he brought down the apartheid regime as a result of economic pressure. And he's not the civil rights leader, the guy leading the marches like John Lewis or Martin Luther King, but he created the Sullivan principles, which are the principles that every multinational corporation now follows, that if they do business in another country, there's 10 or 12 principles, essentially that they will treat the people there the same way they would treat the people in the country that they're domiciled. And he's just a wonderful man. He gave me a lot of his time, and I wrote a lot about him. So I would call him an economic force, not just an energy force. And in the energy field, as I mentioned, the names that I think have been the most progressive names in terms of moving the industry forward.
Ken, we're going to head into a break. And when we come back, I'd like you to talk more about microgrids and where those are heading. We have a lot more to cover, so let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
You're such a prolific writer, I could kind of call out any one of a number of articles, but you just recently wrote an article about grid security. And right. Kind of reminded me at the time, Ted Koppel's book, Lights Out, where we talk about the vulnerabilities of this national electrical grid. Should we be talking more about those vulnerabilities and perhaps the cost to make it less vulnerable?
Well, you know, I don't think if you were going to bring the United States to its knees, and we just spoke about Leon Sullivan and the economic impact he had by asking General Motors to withdraw from South Africa as leverage to get that regime to fall. There was no violence involved. There need not be violence involved to bring the United States to its knees. You can do so from behind a computer sitting in another country simply by gaining access to passwords and firewalls and shut off the grid. And if the electricity stops flowing, businesses stop working and life literally comes to a halt. So it is a more pressing problem than people understand. They understand that if a hurricane comes through and their electricity goes out for three nights, what an imposition that is. Okay. They understand the cause of that was the weather. And then as soon as the weather improves, the utility crew is going to be out trying to fix things and then life's going to resume to normal. But if somebody, if there is a nefarious force out there trying to bring down the grid using computers, that's not something that people are used to, but it has happened. For example, Russia brought Ukraine to its knees by shutting down its grid. Right. And there's thinking that it did the same thing here to a nuclear plant in the United States. So that, and the United States has done the same thing. It did it to Iran. So it's very doable. It works both ways. We've done it and it's been done to us, and it's a very real threat, and there needs to be more recognition of this threat.
And really, hardly, no matter how hard you try, really, it's hard to make it not vulnerable. So one of the solutions, and you've written about that as well quite extensively, would be microgrids and some movement towards decentralized power. I recently wrote an article where I said centralized power plants are no longer woke. And I hovered on the word woke as to whether that was the appropriate word, but I think that's right. For however you tie it, environmental justice, there's just so many reasons that microgrids and decentralized power would be something that would seem to be much more modern and futuristic. So for those maybe who listen to this show and don't understand microgrids, would you walk us through a little bit about your views of microgrids and kind of how they can impact the future in a positive way?
Yes. So the reason microgrids have emerged is a very promising technology. Are one, the move to clean energy, and two, the need for more resilience, and three, the need for economic development. So let's start with the first point, which is the move toward green energy. So if a business puts solar rooftops on, you know, in order to supply its own electricity needs, okay, then it can connect to the grid and return some of that power to the main utility, but it can also set up microgrids so that it's completely islanded from the main grid. And when the sun's not shining, the energy stored in the battery kicks on and they're able to access that and keep powering their building 24/7. So they are not susceptible to things like, this is the resilience part of it. They're not susceptible to things like hurricanes, like in Puerto Rico, when that hurricane went through and destroyed its entire grid. They're now going to on-site energy, clean energy with batteries and microgrids is a way to A, use clean energy, and B, become more resilient so that if the main grid goes down, they continue to have power. And you can also use this same concept in very rural areas that may not have access to the grid. And so if you build a on-site energy with batteries and microgrids, businesses locate in isolated areas and create an economic boom, perhaps, in these areas. So, but the main reasons are clean energy, resilience, and then is it economic development tool. And it's worked very well for some companies. So it right now it's not for everyone because it's just hasn't emerged as sort of a universal concept. It's still a niche concept, but it's come along.
You've written quite a bit as well about battery technology and battery storage. Do you? I'm quick to say that I don't believe that the battery of today at all will be the battery of the future. I study the work around the world, and I'm pretty sure that lithium ion batteries are a nice thing today, but probably won't be what we talk about a decade from today. Do you tend to think that batteries and the cost associated with battery storage will be a technically reasonable solution over the next decade?
I do. I know, because I've been covering batteries for a while, and the improvements over the last 5 years are noticeable. The price has come down. The fact that XL Energy has had a lot of success buying these batteries, I'm quite sure that 5 and 10 years from now, the technology is going to improve. The costs are going to come down. And if battery technology cost improve, if the price comes down, there will be less and less need for natural gas plants to kick on to firm up wind and solar when the weather doesn't permit. So we hope that battery technologies do improve. There are a number of those technologies out there, and without getting into all the nuances of it, because I think it would is a little too much in the weeds. There are different ideas out there, and they're all being tried right now. And in a free market, we'll see which technology ultimately prevails, if including one perhaps that's not even around today.
Yeah. In fact, I would bet good money on technology that exists as not being one that's around today, probably. Well, let me ask you a question from my unique perspective, and that's propane. And I'll start propane, clearly a derivative of natural gas. Probably I would tend to call it its portable cousin. Shares a lot of the same chemistry, other than we're a little bit better in the global warming department. We're at global warming potential is 4. And I don't think even a casual listener or observer realizes what we're doing for power generation throughout the Caribbean. The fact that we've become a fuel of ships, over just the last 3 or 4 years. Do you see a role for propane in this conversation around clean fuel?
I hate to profess my ignorance, but I readily do all the time. So I don't know enough about it to speak intelligently to your audience. I use propane for my grill at home. I've written several articles about Africa, and I know propane is used a lot in Africa. It's been a while since I've thought about the subject. And if I say anything beyond that, I'm just mumbling, and I don't have the background to add anything new to the subject.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the interesting conundrum I think we find ourselves in sometimes. An amazing statistic for me is historically we are 3.5% of the world's energy mix, but we generally touch about 60% of the world's population. And you just mentioned the one most everybody would know is maybe I have a propane grill in my backyard. But even as you think about Africa, I might argue that we are clearly the path towards clean cooking as we move away from coal, oil, wood, dung, whatever. And people just have no awareness of what we're doing in more modern areas, CHP and systems in Japan, where the primary power for the Virgin Islands and half of the Caribbean, I think, right now. So such neat things, yet most energy aware writers and even some technologists don't see it. And I think sooner or later we'll see it, because I think we at least argue that low carbon fuels have a seat at the table in this near term, and we'll see what the long term believes. That's interesting for me. That's what I do. Well, let's kind of turn this around a bit. You know, you're often thinking about the energy space, and kind of want to hand you this magic wand for just a second. Not necessarily thinking just about microgrids or even specifically about any certain type of energy. I'll give you the magic wand. You can change one key thing about the current energy situation, really in the United States, close to home. what's the one thing, the one change that you would wave your magic wand to see happen?
Well, there's many things, okay? So, but I think the key phrase there was close to home. And as we discussed prior to the tape rolling, I'm a West Virginian, and West Virginia has been devastated by the decline of coal. It's not just an economic loss, but the psychological toll it's taken on the people who have lost their livelihoods, it's a lot of drug use, a lot of despair, a lot of loneliness. And so it's not just the loss of coal and as a fuel source, it's the loss as an economic source. It's the loss of people's dignity who worked in this field. And I would hope for the people of West Virginia, for the people of Appalachia, generally speaking, that they would now take this as a chance to have a rebirth, to invest in the energies of tomorrow and to retrain these hardworking folks to work in the fields of tomorrow, and that investment along those lines would come to these poor areas. To that end, this is something that Joe Biden has recognized as part of his energy plan. He would invest in the areas hurt by the decline of coal. I would hope that policymakers here would embrace that, and that this area would grow and reach its true possibilities, its true potential, the same way that the people of California have grown from the growth of new technologies out there, that this area really deserves it, that it's a good peoples who work hard, who need to be part of this new energy revolution.
In the new energy economy that we are probably going to be entering, do you see the lead in that being federal investment or private investment?
Well, that's a great question. And this is also something I've written a lot about, Tucker. In the energy field, I don't care what political philosophy people have. In the energy field, it is always a public-private endeavor. Even in the field of shale gas and drilling and all of that, that was a federal investment, and even the most private-oriented people will recognize that it was the federal government that facilitated shale gas, that's made it into the economic powerhouse that it is today. And it's the same thing with wind and solar. You can argue that these would not have been competitive without federal help, but you can point to any sector, including the oil sector, the coal sector. They've all had federal involvement. So the future of energy is going to be a partnership between the federal government and the private sector. The federal government will supply some of these investment dollars to bring to make it of interest to people in the private sector who can carry the ball the rest of the way. And once these things are on their own two feet, there's no need for any more federal involvement.
Yeah, well said. So we'll start thinking about wrapping up. We've touched a lot. We've touched Appalachia and the coal fields. We've touched nuclear. We've gone to Africa, the rise and fall of Enron. What is something that we haven't really touched in the energy reporting field that you've seen that you would love to have our listeners understand? Anything else?
I think the theme of your program is really something that needs to be underscored, which is how do we get to net zero? How do we use energy in the cleanest, most friendly way, in the most least expensive way to consumers out there? That's the ultimate challenge. And I think that as a society, we are working now toward that goal. We're working to become cleaner. We're working to become more efficient. The price of these technologies, the price of the cleaner fuels, they're all falling. And the sooner we get to net zero, the better off, the better we're going to leave this world for future generations. And it's our job as now senior members of our communities to leave a better society for those that follow in our wake.
Yes, well said. One of the reasons we chose Path to Zero is trying to have a bigger conversation around the issues of health and climate. We had thought we'd get there a bit with the pandemic when, you know, all of a sudden the streets quieted, the skies cleared, and people began to see about the health effects of a cleaner environment. And not just the thermal effects and temperature change, but also improved smog, improved human health from less particulate matter. And, you know, we kind of hope on this program, at least, to keep, you know, the conversation around human health, plant health, you know, certainly the health of the planet. So I do really appreciate, as you say, the integrity in your writing. I've always been a fan of Forbes, but I'm a huge fan now of Forbes because of your writing around energy issues, and I cannot thank you enough for it.
Well, I appreciate hearing that, Tucker. Thank you.
One of the things that we love to do on the show, and I almost don't even want to give you a pick as you sit today in Charleston, West Virginia, but we have the virtual national forest, and we really like to call it the propane national forest. It's a way we thank our guests for being here. We will let you pick the forest, but then through the National Forest Foundation, we actually plant a tree in your name and in your honor. So let me just ask, I almost want to say it for you, but I'll let you pick it first. Do you have a favorite national forest that you would love us to plant the tree in your honor?
Well, I have a slightly different, I'm going to modify your request. This morning, I walked with my dog, who's a golden retriever, 7 years old. We walked 6 miles in Kanawha State Forest, which I do with frequent, I do so frequently. Kanawha State Forest, it's a state forest, but it is a beautiful enclave in Kanawha County, West Virginia, just outside Charleston. And I think that would be very appropriate since I can walk there with my dog and actually see this tree on a regular basis. I can even take my kids there and show them that such a tree was planted in my honor. And ultimately, well,
nothing would make us happier than having a tree that you can see and actually having one that we said we did something in the great state of West Virginia. So thank you very much for that pick.
Well, thank you for doing such a nice thing.
Before you go, anything else you're working on that's coming up that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, a lot of what I've been working on recently has been with the country of China and its relationship to the United States and facilitating trade links once this, you know, it's been a 40-year friendship that sort of got frayed over the last few years. But hopefully this is going to repair itself, and there'll be a lot of trade between these two countries. China is trying to become a cleaner, more efficient place, and it's having great success. The United States has the fuels, the technologies to help them get there, but China is now sort of closed those doors until this sort of dark period is over. And a lot of what I'm doing now is really to facilitate, is writing about trade and trade relations, foreign relations with the country of China. Energy is the main vehicle to do that because energy is a big part of both of our economies. And that's where a lot of my attention is now focused.
Well, we will look forward to those articles. Again, congratulations on the many accolades you've been given. It's just an amazing career, and I cannot thank you enough for being with us today. You've made us, I think, smarter. You've certainly made us better informed and more thoughtful as we all continue on the path towards a low-carbon future. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Tucker. Thank you for having me.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.